the Tsarist era. It was a great big huge structure. It could have survived much longer, but it was just waiting for one big kick, and then it was going to collapse. World War One was that kick. World War One was just such a cataclysmic blow. At peak, the Russians were losing 150,000 dead and wounded every month. The whole Tsarist state quietly collapses, and it was just based around the Tsar. And what you have in this period is essentially no one's in charge. This is where Lenin steps in, the Bolshevik leader. He said himself, power is lying in the gutter, waiting for someone to pick it up. The so-called Bolshevik Revolution has been mythologized. It was a military coup. They had a small but relatively efficient revolutionary cadre, the Red Guard, who in the main cities seized, you know, the parliament building, the telegraph offices, the armories, all the usual strategic locations, and basically took power without any real mass support. And in some ways, that was the start of the conflict, because then they actually had to extend their power over the rest of the country. That was going to be the hard bit.
Perhaps we could go back 100 years to the beginning of the 20th century and start from there and get your just general understanding of what that era was like. And then we can maybe move into the Russian Revolution and move forward from there.
Sure. I mean, look, in many ways, the Tsarist era was already dead. Long before it actually sort of formally collapsed, it was just kind of running forward on momentum. You know, this is a system which was still in some ways almost feudal. They had finally emancipated the serfs, in other words, freed what were in effect land slaves in the late 19th century. But they had just simply saddled them with massive repayments for the land that they could never pay anyway. It was still basically an agrarian country. It was going through its own industrial revolution quite late, but nonetheless, it was happening. But the main thing was, this is almost like it was a regime, a system which just couldn't reform itself. And it was still living in the glories of the past. 1904, they pick a fight with the Japanese. And in part, and there's a whole variety of reasons for it, like with most wars. But I mean, in part, it was precisely this sense of, look, the Japanese, they're not even Europeans. They're not whites and so forth. You know, they're going to be a pushover. And in fact, the interior minister, in effect, the sort of the head of the police force, actually said, what we need is a nice, victorious little war. Of course, what they weren't aware of the fact was that the Japanese had been modernizing exceedingly rapidly and efficiently. And therefore, they got absolutely hammered in the Russo-Japanese War, created a sort of terrible strains, what's called the 1905 Revolution, that was really just a spate of mutinies and risings all across the country. There was, after that, one last chance to try and belatedly grab the opportunity for reform. Prime Minister by the name of Peter Stolypin sort of tried to push this forward, but he ended up stepping on so many toes that he got himself assassinated, possibly with the connivance of the Tsar, you know, or at least sort of the foreknowledge. And really from that point, the last chance to try and reform this empire had gone. And look, it was a great big huge structure. It could have survived much longer had there not been the terrible calamity of World War One. But it was, to me, I think, a kind of a rotten structure that was just waiting for one big kick, and then it was going to collapse. And of course, World War One was that kick.
And that moment, I recently rewatched Dr. Zhivago with my dad, and it's his favorite film. And that movie captures some of that moment very well in 1917 with, I believe, two different revolutions, one earlier in the year, one in October. Paint that picture for us. What is going on? You just mentioned World War One, but what was the situation like internally in Russia, and how did the Bolsheviks eventually succeed?
Yeah, I mean, this is absolutely crucial. It's worth noting that after all, you know, even only a few months before the Bolshevik Revolution, their leader Lenin didn't think he'd see a revolution in his lifetime. But the point is, World War One was just such a cataclysmic blow. I mean, basically, at peak, the Russians were losing 150,000 dead and wounded every month. I mean, and if you want to compare that, roughly speaking, trying to think, the population of the Russian Empire was about 165,000. Today's modern Russia is 145,000. And in 2.5 years of war in Ukraine, the Russians have lost anything from 600,000 to 900,000 men. So, you know, absolutely nothing to this kind of cataclysm that was taking place. And there wasn't food. People were terrified that they were going to be rounded up to be conscripted for the army. The Tsar, Nicholas II, who was a well-meaning man, I think it's the best one could say about him, he nonetheless was also rather stupid. And he again thought that this was his chance to re-legitimize himself. He made himself commander-in-chief because he then thought he would gain the kudos when they won. But of course, what happens is you get all the blame as you lose. Mm. And so he becomes vastly unpopular. And then essentially what happens is he ends up being toppled by a coup. He's on the train. Suddenly the train is sort of diverted. A delegation of the, well, how does it call them, the great and the good, but certainly the powerful, stop him and basically say, look, you know, for the good of the whole nation, you have to step down. He tries to give the throne to his cousin, Grand Duke Michael, who recognizes a poison chalice when he sees it and says, look, I'll only become Tsar, you know, essentially if there's a vote to make me Tsar. And there's this kind of moment of interregnum, and basically the whole Tsar estate quietly collapses. And it was just based around the Tsar. Remember, the Tsar was the Tsar because God said so. This was the last of the great divine right monarchies. So you don't get to just simply sort of resign and then hand the Tsar's crown to someone else, because that's more or less saying, well, God got it wrong. So, you know, the whole sort of system collapses. So that's the February Revolution. And you have, you know, as is usual, sort of a bunch of people who set themselves up as the new provisional government. But they say, look, they're going to continue the war because they feel they have to. There's always that sense of, well, one more push and we'll be in a better position to make a deal with the Germans who are basically advancing. And that blows away any chance of credibility. And what you have in this period is essentially no one's in charge. You, in theory, you have a parliament and a provisional government, but no one listens to it. You have the rise of these workers' councils in the factories and so forth called the Soviets. And people listen to them, but only in their own little factory, in their own little world. No one's really running the country. And this is where Lenin steps in, the Bolshevik leader. Whatever else one can say about Lenin is, as a ruthlessly practical politician, he's the guy who spotted this. And he said himself, power is lying in the gutter, waiting for someone to pick it up. And so the so-called Bolshevik Revolution, they call it the Great October Revolution, even though by our calendar it's in November, has been mythologized with all the sort of films and things showing, you know, crowds waving red flags running through the streets. It wasn't. It was a military coup. Mm. They had a, you know, small but relatively efficient revolutionary cadre, the Red Guard, who in the main cities seized, you know, the parliament building, the telegraph offices, the armories, all the usual strategic locations, and basically took power. But they took power without any real mandate, without any real mass support. And in some ways, that was the start of the conflict, because then they actually had to extend their power over the rest of the country. That was going to be the hard bit.
There is a treaty that I'm shocked to learn so late in life the details of, which I know you must know quite a bit about, which the Soviets I know made, I believe, in early March of 1918, the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. I'd love to give a little bit of time to have you articulate what that means to you, because in part, I was astonished to recently learn that when the Germans essentially made this deal with the Russians, many Germans, even after the end of the First World War, regarded themselves as the victors because of this treaty. I don't know if that's your general sentiment, but I'd love to give some space to a general audience to have you speak about that treaty and what it meant to the Russians in general and to the Germans too.
Yeah, when the Bolsheviks came to power, they had this wonderful slogan. I mean, in many ways, it's ironic. You think of all the great big volumes of works by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, the umpteen pamphlets have been written out, huge screeds of words, and yet they boil their whole slogan down to peace, bread, land. Three words. Essentially, yeah, peace for the soldiers, bread for the urban workers who are starving, land for the peasants, let them keep their land. And it's not that this actually made everyone support the Bolsheviks, but at least it neutralized society. It meant they'll think, well, okay, I'd like to see this happen. Let's give them a chance. But of course, then the Bolsheviks have to actually make good on that. And they realize that the big mistake that the provisional government beforehand had made had been staying in the war. Yeah. So they decide, look, again, this is Lenin, the political pragmatist again. We just have to get out of the war. And the Germans knew that they had the Russians over a barrel. And therefore, they force this incredibly draconian treaty on the new Soviet government, which basically saw them hand over, for example, pretty much all of Ukraine with all the grain lands and so forth. I mean, very much Ukraine was the breadbasket of the empire in those days. So, you know, it was basically giving the Germans everything that they really asked for in this desperate bid to get out of the war. Because remember, it wasn't meant to be in Russia that the revolution was going to happen. If you go to Marx, he presupposes that the revolutions are going to happen in the modernized, industrialized countries with a large, strong working class. So basically, it was going to be in Britain or it was going to be in Germany. And so for Lenin, he was thinking, well, look, sure, now we're giving up all this territory, but it doesn't matter because soon these countries are going to collapse and the red flag will be flying all across Europe and beyond. And this, none of this will really matter. So that's what they did. And yes, absolutely, from the Germans' point of view, this was a massive victory. Of course, they didn't end up keeping it for long because in due course they were going to have to surrender to the Allies on the Western Front. But nonetheless, you know, at that moment, it seems to be an absolute high point of German fortune, certainly in the East. And it is a massive concession. It angers a lot of Russian nationalists. It frees up a lot of the generals and the armies. Now, some of these armies just going to disappear as everyone just sort of deserts and goes home. But others are going to now start sort of being marched against Moscow and the other revolutionary centers. But nonetheless, yeah, this was a kind of a mark of Russian Bolshevik pragmatism, because they knew that they just could not afford to try and keep fighting this war.
I think for most Americans, which is my primary audience, the sole figure outside of Putin that they know something about is the man who succeeded Lenin. My understanding is Lenin was really only in power for a few years, and Stalin was in power for something like 3 decades. And again, I know this is a massive subject, but I'd love to give you some time to speak about Stalin the man, his ascendancy, and maybe we can talk specifically about his reign of terror and discuss him up until the Second World War. What's important to know about him? What's important to know about Russian history then?
Yeah, you just give me about 4 podcasts worth of questions, but sure, I will do what I can. Look, Lenin, to understand Lenin, in order to explain Stalin, in some ways there were 2 Lenins. There was Lenin, the genuine idealist, who actually believed that all the terrible things he did, and he did many terrible things, were justified by the fact that it was all about bringing about a kind of totally different world, one in which there'll be no oppression, that everyone would live in harmony, etc., etc. Lovely dream. But then there was also Lenin, as I said, that the ruthless political pragmatist who would do whatever was needed in advance of that. And if it meant setting up the sort of secret police that would be the precursor of the KGB, if it meant having people executed, not in just in their hundreds, but in their thousands, so be it, because this is glorious vision. Stalin, he was never one of the kind of the deep intellectual thinkers of the movement. I mean, he did actually write a number of sort of philosophical political works, but nonetheless, that wasn't his thing. He was one of the hard men, the action men. You know, he was, for example, involved in orchestrating before the revolution bank robberies in order to raise funds to support the revolutionary cause and such like. And when Lenin, he had a series of strokes, which indeed sort of meant that he would be taken out of the mainstream political governance. And he became increasingly alarmed about Stalin. And he wrote this sort of final document before he died called his testament. And he added this coda to it, which actually said, you know, Comrade Stalin must be replaced. You know, I mean, he went through all the various leaders talking about their strengths and their weaknesses. Stalin was the only one. He just simply said, this guy has got to go. And he essentially handed this perfect piece of ammunition to the rest of the Bolshevik leadership. But the point is, no one else took Stalin seriously. He was seen as this rather dull bureaucrat more than anything else. Trotsky, one of the other sort of very flamboyant, fiery revolutionary leader, called him Comrade Card Index. And, you know, As a result, no one really wanted to use this kind of political nuke against him. And Stalin was able to outmaneuver them all, aligning with one against the other, and then someone else against the first and such like, you know, because everyone underestimated him. And what Stalin did was basically put himself in a position in which he did have, in due course, pretty much absolute power. And it became clear that the real goal of Stalin was Stalinism, was basically, you know, destroying society and then rebuilding it in such a way that he could remain in power. And so if you look at the sort of his terror, his great terror, and the purges which are involved, the interesting thing is the first people he turned to were the Communist Party, destroying every single potential rival for power. And then cutting through society sector by sector, cutting through the countryside, collectivizing agriculture. In other words, basically sort of taking all land under state control and turning peasants into workers of the state. And when, as many of them did, they resist, breaking them with arrests, with the labor camps, with imposed famines, as happened, for example, in Ukraine and other places as well. It was unfortunately a real reminder that the 20th century was the great century for mass murderers. You know, it was the age of the train, the barbed wire, the machine gun. And Stalin used all of these, plus, of course, the telephone and the telegraph, to create this massive network of labor camps, essentially industrializing the Soviet Union on the back of virtual slave labor. And it worked. And in his own way, ironically, Stalin ended up building the perfect warfighting state. It was catastrophic for most Soviet citizens. There was famine, there was cannibalism in a few cases, all kinds of terrible things. But it turned this essentially agrarian country into an industrialized one. And one that, you know, actually was therefore ready for World War II when it happened.
And for people that are hearing the phrase the Great Terror for the first time, and I know just in a very amateur reading and exposure to these details, they are about as gruesome as anything I've ever come across in terms of, you just mentioned the starvation instances of, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. What does that mean? What does the Great Terror mean for someone who was living in Moscow at the time in the 30s or even on the countryside, was part of his officer class? What was he up to? What was the day-to-day lived experience of that kind of totalitarian terror?
Mass fear, mass paranoia, that sense that you never know if today everything is fine, but you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. The revolutionary leader who you write an article praising today might be claimed to be an enemy of the state tomorrow, and you might end up being sort of caught in the blowback. The knock on the door in the middle of the night, secret police coming in, usually at 2-3 in the morning, in their sort of distinctive black vans, so much so that there are actually sometimes traffic jams in the middle of Moscow as all of these vans picking up people to send them to, you know, maybe the labor camp, maybe a bullet in the back of the head, who knows? Ultimately, Stalin killed more Soviet citizens than Hitler did. I mean, how's that for an epitaph? But not just that. Is that it? It was this creation of this paranoid era of society that, you know, you never knew who was an informant and who was not. There was one particular individual, Pavel Morozov, who became something of a sort of a hero figure, a ghastly hero figure within the Stalinist order. This was a child who informed on his parents, in part because they had been hoarding food. And why had they been hoarding food? They'd been hoarding food to feed him. Hmm. But anyway, as a good little Soviet citizen, he informed on his parents and they were dragged away. And he ended up being killed by, I forget, it was his uncle or his grandfather. And in a sign of just the way that the Soviet system was very much ironically challenged, I remember coming across the, back in Soviet times, the Pavel Morozov orphanage. And I thought, wow, that's either someone has a very dark sense of humor or hasn't really put two and two together. You know, so this idea that you don't even know if your kids are going to inform on you. So, you know, whatever you may think, you're always terribly, terribly careful. And, you know, a lot of the instincts that we still see around today in Soviet, in Russian life, there's a Freudian slip for you, in some ways almost feels as if they've been slightly encoded into the DNA of society from that terrible traumatic time, and a time which it was almost impossible not to be involved. You know, there you were at your workplace and someone starts putting around a petition saying that comrade so-and-so has been, you know, I don't know, bad-mouthing the Soviet system. Praising Western technology could get you 3 to 5 years in a labor camp. So, you know, once this petition goes round and people expect you to sign it. Now, do you sign it? You've never heard comrade so-and-so say anything wrong. But the point is, if you don't sign it, are people going to start saying, oh, does this mean that you support him? So you sign it. And the second, so it's a traumatized society because everyone has skeletons in their closet. Everyone to some degree or another had to basically participate in this horrendous time. I mean, it's very hard to really convey. I mean, there's a brilliant film called The Death of Stalin, very, very black comedy that is out there that actually does actually manage through precisely that this dark humor to convey some small part of why this is such a brutal time.
Yeah. You know, I was raised on films like Saving Private Ryan. And I think in my history classes growing up, it was often conveyed that, you know, the Americans and the British really won the Second World War. And years ago, I was interviewing a historian in Texas who said the war was really won on the Eastern Front, that that's really where the Second World War, the outcome was determined in his mind. And I want to give you some time to talk about the war from the Russian perspective, the Second World War. I mean, I remember reading once that something like 40 to 50 million Russians died in World War II, compared that to something like 400,000 Americans. You can take that however you would want. If it makes sense to start with the Nazi invasion of Russia and just give a, you know, an overview of what happened. But anything that you think for a general public is particularly salient or mind-blowing or extremely important to know, I'd love to have a conversation about the Second World War and the eventual victory led by Stalin of the Russians in that campaign.
Let me start with a particular location. I mean, look, ever since 2022, I have been indefinitely barred from Russia. But nonetheless, before, I used to travel there a lot. The very, very first time I went there, I was still a kid at school and went there in 1980, which immediately gives a terrible sense of my age. And in what was at that point Leningrad and is now returned to its old name of St. Petersburg, there is a huge World War II cemetery, the Piskaryovskaya Cemetery. And it's just mass grave after mass grave, because they just didn't, there were so many dead in this city that was basically besieged for so long. There are more dead in that one cemetery than the total British, American, and French war dead from the entire war. You know, it's an astonishing sign of that. And yes, in part, the casualties were because of some terrible blunders by Stalin and so forth. In part, it was because of the ruthlessness with which Stalin prosecuted the war. But it is also absolutely a sign of the scale. And yes, ultimately, Hitler's armies were chewed to pieces on the Eastern Front. That was, you know, where you had battles on an epic scale. Now, that doesn't mean to say that, therefore, that it was the Soviets who saved us. It was a much more symbiotic process because, in fact, there was a huge amount of aid that was provided, first of all, by the United States and then also by Britain, that helped keep the Soviets going. I mean, even now, the sort of the slang term for a little Jeep-like vehicle is a Willys, from the old Willys Jeeps, because they were just so common within the Soviet army in World War II. You know, so there's a lot of that. I mean, so basically, yes, without the Soviets, it's questionable whether we could have beaten Hitler. But likewise, without the Western allies, maybe the Soviets wouldn't have been able to survive as long as they did. Because it really was quite close at one point. In the early, the minute Stalin had miscalculated. He'd made a deal with Hitler for the division partition between them of Poland. Totally cynical deal. You know, both sides knew that war was inevitable, but they'd hoped to, for their own reasons, hoped to postpone it. Stalin thought he had basically won himself one more year. So all of his rearmament plans predicated on that. And when his spies were telling him, no, the Germans are about to attack, Stalin just refused to believe it. Again, this, and in a system like this, no one can basically gainsay the leader. So when the actual invasion happened, it was a catastrophic strategic surprise. You know, you had the majority of the Soviet Air Force was destroyed on the ground in the first couple of days. You know, you had cases of hundreds of thousands of people being captured, taken prisoner in that early advance. And so, you know, the Germans are driving forward, and they're driving forward, and they're just beginning to realize just how big a country this is. I remember reading some memoirs of Germans who, you know, who were involved there, and that sort of sense when you simply you're spending days driving through fields and you're still not anywhere near your objective, and days and days. And in classic form, the Soviets relied on scorched earth tactics, torching any sort of depots of food or petrol or anything like that, moving populations. They moved whole industries way off to the east, to the Ural Mountains, defense industries, precisely so that they wouldn't be taken. And you know, eventually, outside Moscow, if you travel into Moscow from Sheremetyevo Airport, the main international airport, there's a point where you pass these huge sort of angular metal tank traps, which are marking the closest point the Germans got to the capital. And there's this story, partly apocryphal, but you know, in some ways too good not to use, about precisely that they sort of they had their usual May Day parade celebrating the sort of formation of the Soviet Union. And literally the soldiers went through Red Square and then just carried on to the front line. But by dint of, yes, numbers, by dint of the industrial capacity that Stalin had built up, by dint of the fact that they actually they proved to have some extraordinarily competent generals, and that this was an existential war for them. I mean, remember, as far as Hitler was concerned, the Slavic people were untermenschened. They were under people. The future, as he saw it, for the Soviet Union was simply to become colonized by a sort of an aristocratic class of Aryans, who would have their sort of illiterate Slavic peasant slaves working the fields for them, those whom they hadn't killed. So, you know, actually there was this extraordinary upwelling of patriotism. And yes, bit by bit, the advance was, again, I'm simplifying dramatically, but again, we haven't got about 3 hours for a blow by blow. You know, the advance was halted and then in due course rolled back. And yes, basically, the Soviets continue to roll all the way to Berlin.
I heard an incredible fact recently that I wanted to read out. And to get your views on this, and also to have a general opinion of how close they came to taking over the Soviet Union. This is the fact. By the end of 1941, millions of Russian POWs had been murdered by Nazis. At that time, a larger number than of Jews that had been killed to that point. How close did the Nazis come to taking over at that time, the Soviet Union, all of that land, in your judgment?
I mean, see, this is a difficult thing because we, you know, we're playing what if games. Now, they might have taken, I mean, frankly, yeah, it's amazing that Leningrad held on, St. Petersburg held on as long as it did. Likewise, Moscow could have fallen. But that doesn't necessarily mean the end of the war. I mean, this was a mistake that Napoleon had made 100 years earlier, well, 150 years earlier, in the sense of, you know, he had taken Moscow. And then he sort of sat there thinking, well, look, I've taken your main city. This is the point where you come to me and surrender. And these Russians didn't seem to understand that that was how the game was played in Europe. And they didn't. And then in due course, Napoleon is forced to retreat in this long, bloody march back home. So, you know, it is possible that the Germans would have taken those. But whether that actually would have meant the end of the Soviet Union, especially given that the industrial center of gravity had moved eastwards, we really don't know. You know, it would have been a massive psychological blow. And it's possible that, you know, Soviet resistance would have just collapsed. Or it could be, as in 1812, that they would just simply say, fine, you've got a city, we've got lots more, we can outlast you, we can out awful way of putting it, we can outdie you in the sense that we have a lot more people and things could have still gone Soviet's way. We don't really know.
Yeah, fair. I want to move to the Cold War. And, in short order, I want to move closer to modern times. And the man I know that you write a lot about and have written a lot about, Vladimir Putin. But I'd love to maybe start with the beginning of the Cold War after the Second World War. I know Oppenheimer was all over the world last year and won Best Picture. So it's top of mind to some degree. But I'd love to maybe give you some space between 1945. I don't know if the Korean War makes sense to go over, but the time period between the end of the Second War and the time that Vladimir Putin comes on the scene as, I understand it, a KGB agent in East Germany, and I think the 70s or 80s. What matters in that range to you now to, again, a modern audience that's trying to understand a country that they really don't know that much about, that is in world headlines every single day, and they're just curious to learn where everything that is in the headlines has really come from? What matters in your mind about that, those few decades of the Cold War after the Second World War ended?
I mean, I think I would start with the fact that the Second World War totally changed the Soviet Union's place in the world. Mm. Beforehand, it had been something of an international pariah. It was this nasty communist regime somewhere over there. But also, no one really rated it as being that strong. I remember once reading a British military intelligence report that said, well, the Red Army is all right, but it's not Poland. You know, they regarded Poland as the military powerhouse of Eastern Europe and the Russians as also rants. Well, you know, actually things didn't work out quite that way. So, you know, it comes out of World War II, firstly, one of the victors. Secondly, in charge or in control over a great big swath of East Central Europe, which it's not planning on giving up. And facing, a Britain, which was a sort of the great world-spanning empire that is now in exhaustion and about to start losing its empire. France, it's even more sort of accelerated along that particular trajectory. So, suddenly everything in the world seems up for grabs. And clearly, from Stalin's point of view, he wants to assert his place on the world stage. And this is really where the kind of Cold War comes from. Because with nuclear weapons, direct competition is no longer at all possible because the prospect of absolute thermonuclear annihilation is too great. But nonetheless, there are all sorts of other ways in which you can compete in, proxy countries, whether it's Korea or Vietnam or Nicaragua or Angola or wherever. And you compete in other ways of the space race, the Olympics, you name it. And in that context, I mean, the problem is, again, just like the Tsarist Empire fell because it couldn't reform properly, so too really with the Soviet Union. Stalin had managed to industrialize in that big, crude, stamping out great big chunks of metal to roll onto the battlefield. But the war had totally changed technology, not just in terms of nuclear weapons, but we were kind of beginning to move towards the electronics age and then in due course the computing age. And the Soviet Union was going to have real trouble keeping up. It was still very much kind of mired in the past. The paranoias of the regime actually got in the way of technological development. Now, I mean, for a long time, photocopiers, you could not, as a private citizen, have a photocopier. And if you had a photocopier in the office, literally the police would come and check regularly to make sure you weren't using it for unauthorized photocopies. I mean, this is a truly paranoid state. And so, what you actually get is, although, the early years of Soviet power seem to show all kinds of successes, a lot of them are actually cosmetic. Take the great shock that was when it was the Soviets who launched the first satellite into orbit, Sputnik. Well, when it comes down to it, the Sputnik was a nothing satellite. It was a silver football that just went ping in orbit, and they launched it by basically putting it on a converted intercontinental ballistic missile. The reason the Soviets were able to get out there first is because they cut corners. They didn't bother, trying to work out a proper satellite that would mean anything or anything like that. It was just in order to get up there to basically show we can get there first. So there's a lot of this was actually for show rather than anything else. And, you know, although there are ebbs and flows to Soviet power and to various leaders, by the 1970s, I mean, this is a system which is already finding it increasingly hard to keep up with the Americans. I mean, people are shocked at the moment that Putin's government is spending about 7.5 to 8% of GDP on defense. Well, in the mid-late 70s, the Soviet Union was spending 15% of its entire gross national product on the military and security. And it wasn't working, quite frankly. They had lots of stuff. But the point is, as we've seen in Ukraine and elsewhere, numbers do matter in war, but technology, advance, and morale also all matter. They ended up stuck in this war in Afghanistan. I mean, a stupid war. You'd think that people would learn the lesson, but nonetheless, it doesn't seem to happen. Everyone, from the Brits through to the Russians, the Soviets, and then the American allies, it seems to be that everyone has to have their turn being defeated in Afghanistan. But nonetheless, you know, again, they ended up fighting this 10-year war that they never really managed to win. And so, you know, basically by 1980, by the time when Ronald Reagan has come to power in the United States, you know, it is clear that, frankly, this is not a system that can really survive the way it's going at that moment. It's deeply corrupt. It's lacking in all kinds of basic goods. And no one really believes anymore. The ideology, the thing that kept this country going, no one believes in Marxism, Leninism. Yes, you have to study it at university. Yes, you have to make sure that any kind of thesis has to have a reference to Marx somewhere on the first page and everything else. But no one believes in anything, really. So, you know, come the 1980s, when exactly, you know, this is when, you know, Vladimir Putin, you know, is just beginning his kind of, well, you know, is moving into his career properly. You know, already you have a system which is like, is it quite dying? Is it dead? But it's at that point where it's going to take either a dramatic change to actually get it to survive, or else the only question is when it gets the kick, that'll make it fall apart.
And the reasons why people no longer believed, was it simply a matter of general economic and social stasis? In your judgment, what was the long road to that conclusion at a mass scale that eventually led to the dissolution of the entire system?
I mean, really, it's the massive gap between the rhetoric and the reality.
Yeah.
You know, you talk about the fact that this is a workers' state, and yet the workers live miserably. You talk about the fact that it's not like the nasty, corrupt West, and yet the levels of corruption are massive. And basically, everyone has to play the black market. If I can give another anecdote, when I was doing my PhD in the dying days of the Soviet Union, this was kind of period of 1988 to 1991, at one point I had scored a meeting with the minister councillor at the Polish embassy. And because the ambassador was back in Warsaw, he was actually at that time the acting ambassador in one of the largest embassies of, you know, one of the Soviet satellite states. And, you know, I was young and stupid and thought, oh, wow, this is really, you know, this is an important thing. And I went there and we talked for a while, and he was talking about a meeting he'd had in the Kremlin. And I was thinking, oh, wow, this is all great. And then he sort of stopped rather embarrassed and said, look, I'm sorry, for the moment, we're going to have to cut this short. We can meet again. But I have a meeting. And he picks up this plastic bag that clanks. And it transpired that he knew someone who was selling soft toilet paper. And he was off to go and swap Polish vodka for soft toilet paper. So you had the most important Polish diplomat in Moscow having to play the black market just to be able to wipe his own bottom comfortably. You know, and this kind of really brought to the fact that basically everyone was actually being a capitalist in a very kind of primordial street corner way. So I think by this point, it is clear that all the great promises about, you know, the future full of prosperity and equality had actually turned into a future of not just considerable poverty, but also massive inequality. Because if you were in the party elite, you didn't even have to worry about traffic jams. There was a special lane in the center of the main highways, which were for the emergency vehicles, but also for the big black limousines of senior party members. So, you know, they were fatter cats than you'd find in any capitalist state.
Fascinating. And this is getting us much closer to today. And my understanding is the official dissolution date of the Soviet Union is December 26th of 1991. And I'd love to give you some time to introduce a name everyone who will listen to this knows well, Vladimir Putin, and give you some time to talk about his background. I know you write a lot and know a lot about organized crime in Russia, and I don't know if it makes sense to weave that into his story from the jump, but to get an idea of his own worldview, where he comes from, and what informs, in your judgment, the man that we have all come to know a lot more about in the, especially the past few years. What's his story? What's important to know about his trajectory, his upbringing?
I mean, in a way, it's precisely that he was never one of the insiders, the charmed circles of the party and so forth. You know, he came from a fairly impoverished background, raised in the still ruins of post-war Leningrad. He wasn't stupid, but nor was he especially sort of bookish. He ran with youth gangs. That's how he started to get involved in martial arts and things. And when he was still a kid, he went to the Bolshoi Dom, the big house, which was the nickname of the KGB headquarters in Leningrad. And this was also had been the headquarters of Stalin's secret police. So it's as blood-soaked a building as you can find. There was this old joke about why is the Bolshoi Dom the biggest building in Leningrad? Well, because even from its basement, you can see Siberia. So this is not a place on the whole people went to willingly, but he went still as a school kid. And no doubt a slightly sort of awkward and embarrassed sort of desk officer. He basically said, okay, well, how do I join the KGB? And he was told, look, you don't apply. We approach you. And anyway, you know, go and do your degree at university. And even then he said, well, what degree should I do? And the guy said, law. So off he went. He applied himself. He went to Leningrad State University. And indeed, in due course, he joined the KGB. But again, it wasn't because he was a Marxist-Leninist and he wanted to be the sword and shield of the Communist Party, as it's kind of the KGB's logo is. It was basically because, in my opinion at least, the KGB was the biggest gang in town. It was a place where you had the most security, and it was a place where if you were an outsider, you didn't have Communist Party members as your parents or whatever, you could still rise. So it was a very pragmatic choice. The problem was he wasn't very good. And we've actually got some of his personnel records. And he was a kind of, he was a solid B. You know, he had wanted to get into the first chief directorate, which is the elite part of the KGB, which is the foreign, the espionage, the spies, the urbane Soviet James Bonds. But he wasn't. He was actually involved in essentially keeping tabs on dissidents at home. But then he had a lucky break. He spoke good German. They needed someone in the first chief directorate to act as liaison in Dresden in East Germany. And so he sort of got in, but even then, he was not a spy. He was in many ways a glorified file clerk. He was involved in just routing documents between the KGB and its East German counterpart, the Stasi. And the interesting thing is, so he's there for most of the 1980s. And it's a comfortable, low prestige gig. He drinks a lot of German beer. He puts on quite a bit of weight. He handles his paperwork. Meanwhile, back in the Soviet Union, you've got this extraordinary turmoil. You've got the rise of Mikhail Gorbachev, this man who wants to try and bring reform and sort of save essentially the Communist Party and the Soviet Union. You have a period of massive optimism, which then gives way to huge disillusion as the economy starts to nosedive. You know, it turns out this is almost impossible to, again, almost impossible to reform this system. And you try, the more you tinker, the more you actually destroy it. The whole East European empire, shall we say, of the Soviet Union collapses. East Germany goes. He's forced to leave East Germany, go back to the Soviet Union in time for the Soviet Union to implode too. So, here's this guy who joined the KGB because it was going to be his fast track to success. Didn't really work out that well. He's had not one but two authoritarian regimes collapse around him because, in his view, because their governments were just too weak and didn't stand up to the mob or whatever. And he suddenly finds himself in this new country, this Russian Federation, that no one really knows what it's going to be. He's out of a job. and he's going to have to adapt. And you mentioned organized crime. I mean, the interesting thing is he's lucky in that he soon gets a job in the office of the mayor of what is now, once again, St. Petersburg, because it's his old law professor. And there, his job is liaison. In other words, connecting with whoever needs to be connected to. And yes, this means Russian companies, it means foreign companies, but it also means the city's burgeoning organized crime scene. And this is really where he finds himself. You know, up to now, he's been mediocre. He's been a mediocre student. He's been a mediocre KGB officer. He turns out to be a very good, let's call it, political entrepreneur, taking his connections, making sort of links, acting as the mayor's bagman. You know, basically, that's where he really starts to emerge as a serious figure, is in this kind of, you know, as the overlap between the worlds of politics, business, and crime, which frankly were all bled into each other in that 1990s decade.
And his luck continues. I mean, his rise, as I understand it, is directly linked to the life and career and eventual decline of Boris Yeltsin. And I don't know if it makes sense to just continue to transition the story from that relationship, but at the turn of the century, I know just from an American perspective, there was great optimism about the future of how Americans and Russians and the West and Russia in general would be able to work together, which obviously have not gone as the often over-optimistic Americans were hoping that it would. Maybe we can start with that relationship with Yeltsin and continue with the trajectory of this man in whatever details you think matter.
Sure. Well, look, Yeltsin was very much a destroyer, not a creator. You know, he had been a heavy-handed party boss whom Gorbachev had brought to Moscow. Because he'd stepped on too many toes, Gorbachev ditched him. And from that point onwards, Yeltsin had a really personal enmity. And very much it's Yeltsin who basically blocked Gorbachev's last desperate efforts to save the Soviet Union. And so there you had suddenly had Yeltsin now is the president of Russia. Great. But that's the whole point. He was very good and focused when he had a clear enemy. When he didn't have an enemy, when actually it was a time to create, that's when Yeltsin more or less fell apart. He had no real vision of what a democratic Russia should look like. He frankly tended to go back to abusing pills and booze in those times when he didn't have an enemy. And so, you know, you had this kind of muddled, messy era in which, you know, a handful of Russians were basically privatizing whole industries into their back pocket for kopecks on the ruble. This was a time, you know, through the 1990s, Mercedes sold more bulletproof limousines in Russia than in the rest of the world put together. And I remember it. I mean, it was a hard, hard time for almost all Russians. You know, you would go to even Moscow, which was, you know, the wealthiest of the cities. And while you're having neon signs appearing on the buildings and, yeah, the limousines of the super rich passing on the streets, you would have lines of pensioners outside the metro station selling anything that they had, you know, one shoe or anything, because their pensions were essentially worth nothing. So it was a very hard time. And I think the problem was in the West, we were focusing on other things. Yes, it was great. The Cold War was over, the peace dividend and so forth. We didn't really pay too much attention to the detail of what was happening in Russia. And in particular, two key points. In 1993, Boris Yeltsin gets into a constitutional rivalry with his parliament, shells it into submission, literally as his tanks blow holes in the parliament building. Now, the parliament was an unpleasant group of people who had largely been elected in Soviet times, and we didn't like those people. But the point is, technically, according to the constitution, what Yeltsin did meant that he was no longer president. But still, we didn't like that parliament, so we cheered Yeltsin on. Then in 1996, it looked as if Yeltsin was actually going to lose an election to the Communist Party. And the elections were massively rigged to ensure that didn't happen, and we knew it. But we hadn't wanted the communists to win, so we told Yeltsin, good for you, and such like. And then, unfortunately, and look, I'm not saying, oh, everything's the West's fault, but nonetheless, we have to also accept our responsibility. Unfortunately, this contributed to a sense amongst Russians that basically democracy is a sham, that the West doesn't really like Russia, and so forth. And it paved the way for someone, not necessarily Putin, but someone like Putin to take over. But meanwhile, Putin had been exactly doing his job as everyone's favorite bagman. When the mayor who'd been his patron lost the elections, he comes to Moscow, he gets a job in the Presidential Property Directorate. He spends a year in charge of the FSB, which is like kind of the KGB's successor. And, you know, impresses a lot of people with the fact that he seems to be exactly, he's loyal, he's discreet, he's efficient. And so a bunch of people around Yeltsin, who is getting more and more erratic and frankly, no, clearly could no longer do the job, are thinking, well, look, we need to anoint a successor who's going to protect us, look after our interests and so forth. And they think, well, this Putin guy, he's exactly the guy we need. So in 1999, he's made prime minister. Then Yeltsin stands down as president. So Putin becomes interim president, stands for election in 2000 with all the advantage of incumbency, as well as a sort of massive media, you know, sort of hoopla around him, gets, I think it's about 53% of the vote, which is enough to become president. And at that point, he reveals that he's more than just someone's bagman. That's the point at which he sort of turns around and basically starts to assert himself and gathers the big businessmen who'd all been backing him and says, okay, fine, you can keep everything that you've stolen up to now, but understand that now the state is in charge. But the point is, this is it. It's essentially a time in which, yes, we had high hopes of relations with Russia. Ironically, Putin had high hopes of relations with us. But the trouble is, none of us really understood the other. Putin thought that, look, it doesn't really matter what he does at home as long as he supports us abroad. You know, global war on terror, no problem. You know, he offered to the Americans that they can resupply their forces through Russian airspace and on Russian railways and so forth. And he more or less thought, well, look, I'm doing this favor for you. So you're going to turn a blind eye when I sort of massacre the Chechens who are rebelling against me at home. And when the West doesn't, he thinks, hey, you know, isn't this a broken deal? And, you know, so very quickly, actually, you know, all these nice words start to become hollow, precisely because we'd not really understood Putin or Yeltsin, for that matter, and they certainly hadn't understood us. Hmm.
And is the key misunderstanding, I heard it put once, that to regard the Russian government as more akin to a mafia state than anything else would let many of their actions make more sense to a Western audience than anything else. What do we misunderstand? How do you think we might be able to have a framework or rules of thumb to think about that system in general under Putin that can help us make sense of their general outlook, specifically with Putin himself?
I mean, I'd say two things. I mean, I don't really like this mafia state characterization because it implies that the state runs organized crime, organized crime runs the state. That's not quite the way it is. Hmm. It is, of course, a kleptocracy in which everyone who's got any kind of position of power enriches themselves. But there's a lot of countries in the world that are kleptocracies, and we somehow manage to deal with them. I mean, Britain in particular, I'd say. Hmm. I think really there's two things that we misunderstood. First of all, Putin is not mysterious. I mean, actually, a lot of the things he's been saying for a long time. Even before he was president, for example, he was saying that basically Ukraine isn't really a country and that Eastern Ukraine is really a part of Russia and so forth. There's lots of other things. But we always thought, oh, well, that's just for the domestic political audience or whatever. We refused to take him seriously, what he said. And I think the second thing is to kind of understand what kind of a country this is. This is, Russia is a weird hybrid country. On one level, it's a modern bureaucratic institutionalized country like any other. You know, it's got ministries and interest groups and such like. The big difference is, on top of that, it's got this almost medieval court, where actually the main currency is the favor of the president. And everyone is simply trying to sort of make sure that basically Putin will let them have powers, perks, you name it. And that is, I mean, for me, it's the fascinating thing about studying modern Russia. But it's also the exasperating thing is because there, you know, the politics of personality can change daily. Hmm. Someone can just make the wrong joke. And suddenly they're no longer the favored son. There are, you know, real close cronies of Putin's who don't really talk outside. You know, they, yes, some of them might give occasional interviews and things, but basically speaking, it's a black box. of exactly, you know, who Putin talks to. And the real power often doesn't relate to the apparent power. You know, take the foreign minister. On one level, the foreign minister is a really powerful job. In practice, these days, he has no power because basically he's not a mate of Putin's. Whereas other people, actually, because they're mates of Putin's, they have massive influence, but they don't have what seem to be the powerful jobs. So I think this is it. We have to understand what kind of a state we're dealing with. And that's quite difficult because, you know, on the whole, governments like to assume that other governments are like them.
I know we're getting short of time. This has been absolutely fascinating. I'd love to close with a couple of different points and have you give as much time as you would like to both of them before we wind this down. The first is the only real opposition that I think to a Western audience we have heard of in the last many years, a man who recently died, Navalny, and his life and how he matters in your mind in the Russian consciousness and the opposition to Putin. And then in general, a question I'm sure you must get all the time, which is, in your judgment, how does this war end if it does? I'd love to close with those two.
Okay, Navalny, I mean, extraordinary figure. I mean, the very fact that after he'd been poisoned by the state and then was in Germany recovering, and even then after that, he went back to Russia. He went back to the country whose leaders had tried to poison him. I mean, as an expression of both bravery and patriotism, it's very hard to beat. I mean, the thing about Navalny is interesting because he was young, he was charismatic. If he had been born in the West, he probably would have been, you know, sort of prime ministerial material or else running a talk show. But he was very much, I would say, a kind of a representative of a new generation of Russians, precisely the post-Soviet generation. I mean, this is the key thing. You know, Putin and co, they really are. I remember sort of most people around Putin are between the ages of 68 and 74. They really are Homo Sovieticus through and through. And you've got this new generation of Russians who are not necessarily afraid. They're certainly not prey to the same kind of assumptions, of the Soviet era. And for Navalny, yeah, I mean, he basically was just refused to accept, as it were, Putin's reality. You know, he tried to use the laws, for example, to actually sort of assert the rights of Russians and so forth. And yes, absolutely, Putin essentially had him killed. I mean, we don't know if he was actually actively killed in a high north hard labor prison camp, or whether it was just that he was deliberately put in terrible circumstances in which his nerve agent compromised system wasn't going to survive anyway. But one way or the other, you know, he wasn't coming out of that labor camp, alas. And his movement has basically been dismantled. Mm-hmm. Lots of people within it have fled into exile, or just they're in prison, or they're just keeping their heads down and so forth. But nonetheless, I mean, you know, what Navalny stood for isn't going away. We see actually a lot of Russians still extraordinarily bravely protesting against the war or against particular issues, everything from environmental issues to language laws. But the other thing it's worth mentioning is, yeah, we in the West tend to focus on people like Navalny. I mean, rightly, understandably on one level, because also they're liberal, they're pro-Western and so forth. There's another strand of opposition to Putin, which is actually ultra-nationalist. People who, let's say, didn't, for example, have a problem with the invasion of Ukraine in principle, but have a problem with just how damn badly it's being done. And if you look at the mercenary commander, Yevgeny Prigozhin, who mutinied against Putin's state last year, I mean, in a way, he has become almost the patron saint of these so-called turbo patriots. And so I think this is the problem. There's a lot of protest potential in Russia. There's a lot of people who are unhappy, but there's no clear structure or leader. And at the moment, it's all being kept under control because, frankly, if you're in a brutal police state, you have to have some real belief that things can change before you actually take the risk of going out and protesting on the streets. Someday that's going to happen. There's going to be some black swan event that triggers it. We and Putin have no idea who is in effect going to capture that protest movement. Is it going to be some leftist who wants to bring back proper ideals of Marxism-Leninism? Is it going to be some sort of technocrat who says we just have to live better? Is it going to be a liberal democrat? Is it going to be some proto-fascist nationalist? I mean, this is the thing. We have no idea. It's one of the big uncertainties. But speaking of uncertainties, you also asked about the Ukraine war, which has been a war that really has defied prediction. I mean, I think the trouble is we are in a situation in which it's hard to imagine either side being able to actually deliver a knockout blow to the other. Look, the days when it was a possibility that Russia was going to be able to take Kyiv and move on, I think that's gone. I mean, I think victory from the Russians' point of view basically means holding on to southeastern Ukraine. But likewise, the idea that the Ukrainians are going to be able to kick every single Russian out of every single square inch of occupied territory is looking unlikely. And frankly, doesn't end the war in itself. It just moves the battle line to the national border. I have a nasty feeling that at some point, both sides are going to be exhausted. And therefore, in some ways, we're going to see, if not a peace deal, but a kind of a grudging ceasefire emerge, which is going to leave the Russians in control of a certain amount of Ukraine, not internationally recognized, but nonetheless, that's probably where they'll be. And honestly, I think that we in the West will remain in a kind of non-shooting political war with Russia, so long as Putin is in the Kremlin. Even if the Ukraine war ends next month, next year, we can hope so. That doesn't mean to say we're going to go back to business as usual. So in some ways, we are in this nasty Cold War 2.0 for some time to come, which is not the most encouraging note on which to end, alas.
And to sneak in one final question there, in your mind, what is the best case possible outcome with this situation? I assume based on what you just said, you think that Putin would be open to a negotiated settlement or ceasefire with the West at some point in maybe not the not too distant future. What is in your judgment, absent his death? I mean, the man I believe is in his 70s, so he's not going to be around forever, but what threads of optimism, if any, do you have as you look out into the next few years, the next 5 years in general, in terms of the relationship and the reality of what's happening over there?
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't think Putin is going to be willing to talk, at the moment at least, on anything but his terms. But I am still unfashionably optimistic about Russia in the long term. But I mean, we should say long term, generationally. I think that when Putin goes, I think he will be, as I said, the last gasp of the Homo Sovieticus. And in a way, I am putting my faith in corruption and kleptocracy. Because if you look at the next political generation below, the 50-somethings, the early 60-something-year-olds, the ones who are waiting quite impatiently for their chance in power, they are opportunist kleptocrats. They are people who believe in stealing on an industrial scale and enjoying that. And frankly, to properly enjoy that, they want to improve relations with the West. Putin is much more ideological. Putin genuinely believes that the West is hostile to him and to Russia, and that he is somehow pushing back against this hostile West. I don't really get the sense of that same kind of real fervor in the generation below. They're not nice people. They're not Democrats. But nonetheless, I think these are people who will want to improve relations with the West. Firstly, just because, you know, what's the point in stealing if you can't park your yacht off the Italian coast and enjoy your nice penthouse in London and send your kids to an American university and such like? I mean, there's a huge black market nowadays in BMW and Mercedes spare parts, but still. But also, really, in the longer term, Russia has the option of either improving its relations with the West or becoming a vassal of China. It really is as straightforward as that. And frankly, I have heard many people within the Russian system essentially admit that they don't want to just simply become a vassal of China. So I think, you know, when Putin goes, not instantly, but, you know, we will actually see a shift towards an attempt to basically try to normalize relations with the West. So, you know, it's not exactly a beautiful sunlit upland, but nonetheless, it's a damn sight better than what we see at the moment.
Yeah. Amazing. Mark, this was such an honor. I really appreciate the time. I think the listeners are really going to enjoy this one. So thank you so much.
It's my great pleasure.
The time in doing this. Best of luck with all your work.
Thank you very much.